Hi, Amy.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very well. I'm glad we can do this summertime blogging hens.
Yeah, me too. So I'm Sarah Posner. I'm a senior editor at Religion Dispatches, and I'm here with Amy Sullivan from Time Magazine. What's your title there?
Contributing writer.
Okay. So, and we've both been writing about sort of similar things lately, and we're going to talk primarily today about religion and the Republican presidential candidates. So let's start with Rick Perry and not only his prayer rally, which people have known about for a few weeks, but thanks to you and a couple of other people, some information has started to come out about meetings arranged by the televangelist James Robeson, who's based in Dallas, putting together conservative religious leaders, not only in support of Perry's prayer rally, but possibly in support of a Perry candidacy, although that latter point is a little less clear.
Right, and it's probably worth just commenting at the beginning here that the fact that we're talking about Rick Perry and the support of religious leaders tells you a little something about the existing slate of candidates who have declared that they're
That's
running
right.
for the nomination. We'll get to that later, but
right.
you know, it's interesting that there's so much activity going on around a guy who hasn't declared that he's running.
Exactly.
And hasn't even done a, you know, I may have an exploratory committee and then run.
Right, and he hasn't been to Iowa, although Politico reported last week that he's been making calls to activists in Iowa.
Right,
but there's an outside right, and there's an outside group, you know, officially not connected with any campaign of Perry's. Mm-hmm. It's a 527 group. Organized under, you know, Section 527 of the IRS code. It's called Americans for Rick Perry, and they secured a spot at the Ames straw poll for August because I guess since he doesn't really have a campaign, he couldn't or wasn't in time to secure one himself. Mm-hmm. So he definitely has people working on his behalf to try to get into the early states, even though, like you said, he doesn't even have an exploratory committee yet.
Right, and it may be that that's a little tricky for him, given the timing of the prayer rally, because I'm not the world's expert on campaign law here. But to have an outside group, in this case the American Family Association, spending $1.5 million on an event that is basically entirely focused on Rick Perry, I think he has to hold back on declaring his candidacy until after that takes place.
That's really interesting because, well, first of all, let's just clarify what the timing is here. So his prayer rally in Houston is August 6th.
And then the Ames
straw poll is the 13th. And I think he also has a plan that week when many of the other candidates, although not all of them, will be in Iowa, to be in South Carolina, which is
also
one of the
early primary
states. Yeah, so that's his time is interesting, but you raise a really interesting point about the American Family Association sponsoring or hosting or whatever the term they're using is this rally, because a couple of years ago, the watchdog group Texas Freedom Network asked the IRS to investigate a group called the Niemöller Foundation, which was also a 501c3 tax-exempt organization that appeared to be behind the Texas Restoration Project and some of its, not rallies per se, but these pastors' policy briefings that they had, where they frequently featured Rick Perry, who at the time was running for governor of Texas. And the Texas Freedom Network asked the IRS to investigate whether that constituted an illegal endorsement of Rick Perry's candidacy because the Niemöller Foundation was a 501c3. Organization. And the IRS, as it often does, didn't investigate. And so basically resulted in the Niemöller Foundation being, you know, not cleared, but not investigated. You know, it was basically, I guess, cleared. So I wonder if they used that, or in their thinking, are using that to think, well, hey, you know, we got away with it having a 501c3 behind, that was essentially behind Rick Perry's gubernatorial candidacy through these pastors' policy briefings. Let's try it again if he runs for president.
It's possible. I mean, the Iowa affiliate, or I guess they're not all connected, but there are different restoration projects in a few different states. And the Iowa group got into a bit of trouble, not with the IRS, but with other conservatives in 2007, I think it was, in the run-up to that presidential cycle.
Well, people were angry.
These pastors' policy briefings,
and only having Mike Huckabee there. Right.
And they would say, oh, we invited all the other candidates. And the other candidates would say, we never got the invitation.
No, you didn't. Right, exactly. I remember that. And so I wonder how they're figuring to get around this time, although I do know that there was one of these restoration or renewal projects in Iowa, and they did invite the other candidates. I think that Santorum and Bachman attended. So it's interesting. I mean, and Gingrich. But Gingrich actually had a history of attending them back in 07 and 08, but he wasn't running at the time. But I remember talking to people from the Fred Thompson campaign and the Ron Paul campaign, and they were very irritated that these were Huckabee-focused events. But it's still clear, I don't know, it's not clear to me that the group that Robeson assembled is of one mind about Perry being behind Perry for president. I mean, I think that there is obviously support for him getting in the race, possibly because they think the other candidates are, you know, not quite up to snuff from their perspective. So, I mean, I think apart from A, the IRS issues, and B, the issues with other conservatives being annoyed about other candidates not being invited, I wonder if even there's even unanimity among the 72 or however many people. You know, Robeson released the list last week of the people who had been.
I'd be shocked if there was.
Because
we've seen, you know, in 2008, it seemed like the religious right leaders were just all over the place in terms of who they were supporting. Pat Robertson endorsed Rudy Giuliani, just to give everybody a sense of how, in some cases, odd the Perrians were. But as you have rightly pointed out in some of your pieces, endorsements of religious right leaders are very different in many cases from where evangelicalism grounds are leaning. It's important to know, just because I think it has some bearing and influence on campaigns. You know, the fact that all of the candidates showed up to Ralph Reed's Faith and Freedom Conference earlier this summer told me that there are a lot of folks in Republican campaigns who don't really know who the power brokers are in the religious conservative community, and that Ralph Reed seemed like a familiar name and seemed like a guy who you wouldn't want to turn down, but that they don't necessarily know who you want to go to get the endorsement. That said, you know, it's worth talking about one of the guys who's been in both the Robeson meetings and on the calls, who's John Hagee, a pastor in Texas, who has a very large congregation and who is quite controversial. In fact, so controversial that when he endorsed John McCain in 2008, took the McCain campaign a little while to figure out who John Hagee was and that they didn't want his endorsement. But McCain ended up rejecting it, saying, yeah, we don't really need this guy behind us, because Hagee...
But that actually made other people in the religious right really angry at McCain.
It did, yeah. It gives you a sense of kind of where some of the factions are here, but also what some of the challenges are for a Republican candidate who wants to kind of court some of these guys but needs to be careful about the distance. And so far, Rick Perry has no distance between him and John Hagee.
No,
what
or him and Ron Parsley,
is,
you know, sort of similar situation.
In terms of who people are supporting, Hagee is definitely the person who is pushing a Perry candidacy and trying to encourage everybody else to get behind it.
Well, he's been a Perry supporter for a long time. Right. He has given money to Perry's gubernatorial campaigns. And so, and it's funny that you bring him up. I want to talk about him a little bit more, but mm-hmm. I have this book. You can't see it because you can't see me, but you can only hear me. But I'm holding up this book that John Hagee wrote in 2000. It's called God's Candidate for America. It was an endorsement of George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. I want to come back to Hagee because this is a really interesting story about, you know, McCain rejecting him, yet candidates in this election cycle not seeming to care about the fact, Republican candidates not seeming to care about the fact that McCain had rejected him. But what about Don Wildman and the American Family Association? I mean, they are the host of this prayer rally that Perry is taking the lead on. And, you know, they've put out some of the most outrageous, you know, anti-gay, anti-Muslim rhetoric in over the past year or so. Brian Fisher, who is their director of public policy, I guess is his title, but his main activity appears to be this radio show that he hosts for them on American Family Radio. He routinely compares gay people to Nazi stormtroopers. He says that, you know, Muslims should be deported. They shouldn't be allowed to immigrate here. I mean, the list is very long. This I gave a little flavor of it. I don't have all of the quotes at my fingertips. I mean, this on a very basic level, doesn't this seem rather shocking that someone who is getting ready to run for president is so firmly associating themselves with an organization which is so blatantly bigoted towards so many different Americans?
Well, and I mean, a very isn't divisive that be organization, a too.
Right. Isn't that going to be a problem for Perry? I mean, setting aside the support from John Hagee, I mean, mm-hmm. do you think that the American Family Association support is going to be a problem from that standpoint?
I think it should be a problem.
right. But will
it? No, just saying that, you know, one of the things I noticed right after he announced the prayer rally, which is called the response, was that the Republican governor of Georgia immediately made clear that he wouldn't be attending. And it's assumed, I mean, he's also the chair of Gingrich's campaign in Georgia. Right. But it's assumed that one big reason is that the American Family Association, which one of their most popular or favorite activities is to launch boycotts against companies. And in this case, they've been urging people to boycott Home Depot because Home Depot has sponsored some
same-sex partner benefits, right?
Yeah, well, and yeah. They've participated in some gay rights parades and you know, upset folks over at the AFA. But it turns out Home Depot is headquartered in Atlanta. And the Republican governor of Georgia is too excited about an organization that's trying to financially hurt one of the biggest employers in Georgia. So, you know, already you've got people who aren't too keen on what these folks are doing before you
get to
what
they're saying. But that seems more like a political calculation as opposed to a principled opposition to the AFA's bigotry, or not.
Yeah, but I guess I'm saying that that's the type of divisive organization they are. So even before you get to independent voters who might be turned off by some of the stuff the group says, just the way that they act and the efforts they choose to get behind tend to put people off. And, you know, you've got a lot of big corporations located in a lot of major states who they've gone after. So even for just purely selfish reasons, there are some politicians who aren't going to want to get behind them. But, you know, it is really surprising to me that Perry has just wholeheartedly associated himself with folks like John Hagee or groups like the American Family Association, because usually you'd want to at least have a pretense of, holding them at arm's length while, you know, you've got your other arm slung around their shoulders. And that's not the kind of politician he is. It's not who he's been in Texas at all. He's almost you know, every time I read about Rick Perry, I think all the fears people had about Bush, or the fears that a lot of liberals had about Bush, and that he was, you know, this politician intent on forming a theocracy and, you know, just breaking down walls between separation of church and state. All of that is true with Rick Perry.
Right.
And he's kind of, you know, Bush magnified. And he's, frankly, in the same position that Bush is or was in 2000 in terms of why people are looking to him. You know, if you remember in 99, the religious right was kind of in the same position. They mm-hmm. were excited about Gary Bauer, who people may now have forgotten ever ran for the nomination. But Gary Bauer was never going to win, even if he was one of theirs. So then they got kind of excited about John Ashcroft because he was also kind of a very devout conservative Christian, even if he was Assemblies of God, which wasn't the mainstream of these folks. But John Ashcroft also didn't have a chance. So Bush was kind of the third choice, and people rallied around him because his name recognition was really high, and he was from the South. So he could do well in the primary schedule, and because he was kind of one of theirs.
I think that's that there was
Perry, except that Perry is totally one of theirs.
Right. So I think that the difference there is that Bush knew what right things to say to these people. So when Robeson and these other religious figures in Texas went to him, and you know Robeson, you know, had this meeting with Bush and Karl Rove, you know, back in 98 or 99. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so Bush knew what things to say to them, and then they could say, okay, he said the right things. You know, he said the right things about his personal faith or about his belief in Jesus. And mm-hmm. so we'll bless his candidacy, and they kind of knew that he would also get the blessing of the, you know, the Wall Street part of the party. So they felt like that would come together. And then, you know, in 2008, one of the problems with Huckabee, even though a lot of the religious right figures really did like him, including, you know, Don Wildman, who's now, you know, hosting the Rick Perry thing. But a lot of the people who were reluctant to endorse Huckabee was precisely because the Wall Street part of the party wasn't happy with him. And so I think that they're looking at the field now, like you said, and they're not seeing somebody who satisfies all of those things.
Yeah.
But it's almost like Rick Perry didn't get the memo about meet quietly with these people and, you know, reassure them in private that, you know, you've got them on your mind when you're making policy, and, you know, talk about your personal faith with them in private, but don't make this big splash of it, because then, you know, if you make it to the general election, everybody's going to remember that you were on the stage with Don Wildman and Brian Fisher and, you know, whoever else he's going to have on stage with him. So it's kind of weird to me, because it's the Republicans spent a couple of decades putting this strategy together, you know, this sort of Doug Weed Bush family strategy. Doug Weed was, you know, the Bush family's, you know, evangelical advisor. You know, this strategy of, like, cultivating many, many different types of religious people from different religious traditions and doing it kind of quietly and politely and not in people's face so much, so that, you know, so that they would be satisfied, and then, like, you're still good when you get to the general election. I just wonder why Perry didn't get that memo. It's just kind of odd to me.
Yeah, I think there are two things going on. One is Perry has been in Texas politics now three times as long as Bush was. And I think that has an effect. I think Bush was there for a short enough period of time that he was still kind of oriented to the national scene.
But doesn't Perry have advisors?
Been in Texas so long that he kind of thinks that's the way you act, and what roles in Texas politics roles nationally, which obviously doesn't. But the second thing I think is more relevant, which is trying to think of a nice way to put this. Rick Perry is not as smart as George W. Bush,
and he is not
the politician that Bush was. And that's not to say that Bush was a genius, but he was smart enough to know how to do this. And Perry obviously must have advisors, but, you know, he makes the call on a lot of this stuff. And I think a smarter, more pragmatic politician would have manage these relationships with a little more finesse.
I absolutely think that's right, but I still find it astonishing mm-hmm. that someone who's considering a run for national office would not have consulted and taken the advice of someone very experienced in running a national campaign and able to give him the advice about doing this a little bit more under the radar. Mm-hmm. However, in a way, you know, all of that said, in a way, it's a good thing, you know, that he's doing it very publicly. In a way, it's very transparent. Right. And so we know exactly, you know, who he's cavorting with and who he's cultivating relationships with. Mm-hmm. So I think we can thank him for that transparency.
Right. Well, and just in the realm of total speculation here, there's been some reporting recently that Perry and Bush are not on the best of terms. Mm-hmm. And Perry is definitely engaged in some somewhat harsh criticism of Bush and his record. And there are a lot of social conservatives who feel that Bush had a lot of potential for them and really
didn't
come on strong in courting them, but yes, didn't deliver. And so, you know, I could see Perry kind of taking Bush advice and dismissing it, thinking, well, but you didn't really come through for these guys. If I want them really in my corner, I can't go halfway.
Right. I mean, in a way, though, I just maybe even if he wasn't taking advice from Bush veterans, just from somebody with
anybody, yeah.
Yeah, from anybody, you know, a national political strategist. But I wonder, so, you know, it's thought that his emergence here and his possible jumping into the race at this point is because of a perceived dissatisfaction with the existing field. I mean, you know, Newt Gingrich is essentially out. Rick Santorum never had a chance. You know, I don't think Herman Cain I don't think his campaign is going anywhere.
Right.
Then you've got Huntsman and Romney. And, you know, Huntsman's not even campaigning in Iowa. He's going straight to New Hampshire. And Romney's got a lot of good fundraising, but there's been a lot of, you know, the sort of the longstanding, can the religious right get behind a Mormon, even though some people in the religious right have supported Romney.
Right. And Romney is skipping the Ames shuffle.
Right. And then you've got Pawlenty and Bachman, who appear to be the gunning for the to win the straw poll next month.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like, you know, Bachman is trying to, is starting to edge out Pawlenty. And he, you know, he attacked her on Meet the Press yesterday. He said she had a non-existent legislative record, which was probably the harshest thing he said about her, but clearly not the harshest thing anybody has said about her. and so, but I wonder, is he, you know, so if you reduce the, if you reduce Perry's real competition down to those two. If he is trying to out religious right them, he's out trying to outdo them, which doesn't seem like a very smart, yeah, but it doesn't seem like a smart general election strategy.
It doesn't, especially because Pawlenty isn't really engaging the religious right.
No.
You know, he's didn't
tiptoeing
show up
around
to
it.
The pastor's briefing in Iowa in March. He came to Ralph Reed's thing, but he was far from, you know, he didn't really have his heart in it.
I barely even remember what his speech was like. I think
it was just his stump speech. He just talked about Tim Pawlenty being a truth teller. In fact, I'm trying to remember. It seemed like he substituted a word or two to appeal to the audience, but that essentially it was his regular stump speech. You know, he
and Bachman
goes
prayed
to a church
with the audience.
Of Leif Anderson, who I
right.
just announced that he's stepping down.
He's retiring.
From the church.
Right.
So he's already kind of more in the orbit of a somewhat, I don't want to say more moderate, but, you know, Leif Anderson and some of the folks on the NEE board are of a different ilk than the people on the Robeson meetings.
Absolutely.
And so it's just an entirely different group that Pawlenty has been talking to and in the same circles as.
But also it's just his approach, too.
Yeah.
I mean, so he's just not as, I don't want to say he's not as dogmatic, because I think he is, but he's not as sensationalistic in his rhetoric.
Yeah, he's definitely not red meat.
And exactly. Or even, he's not even good at the dog whistles that maybe some people don't understand, but the bass does understand. Mm-hmm. I don't even think he does that.
I'm not sure he knows the dog whistles, actually.
Yeah, like, I don't think, I mean, I think that to the bass, Bachman comes across as one of them. She's kind of like the Huckabee of 2012, right? Because she just comes across to the bass as, she speaks our language, she understands us, she's one of us. Mm-hmm. As Huckabee used to like to say when he was campaigning in 08, I'm not speaking to you, I'm speaking from you.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people, not everybody, views her that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was definitely the star at the Ralph Reed conference. You know, the number of standing ovations she got and a loud applause. And, you know, she just knew how to work the crowd because she was one of the crowd.
Exactly. So, yeah, so I get the sense that even if Perry, at first I thought that Perry doing this thing on just a week before the straw poll was dissing the straw poll. But then I started to think that, no, the strategy is that this is his way of campaigning it for the straw poll without going to Iowa.
Well, and maybe even renders the straw poll a little less relevant if you can say, well, Romney's not even there. And even if Bachman ends up winning, Perry just had all this attention, and he's obviously, you know, not shrinking from the religious right and social conservatives. So what really ends up being the barometer of social conservative thought and fervor?
Right.
You know, maybe it's a number
something
of
else.
Things.
Right. Let's cycle back to what we were talking about earlier, was that, you know, the extent to which the rank and file voter takes their cues from some of these leaders that are going to be helping with or at or supporting Perry's prayer rally. Because I think that for the national media, I think that that for a lot of reporters, there's just like, oh, so Don Wildman or whoever else appears to be supporting Rick Perry, so therefore all these people will just say, oh, well, that's who I'm supporting because this guy I like is supporting him. But I think that just like a lot of the Republican strategists don't know who the power brokers are, I think for a lot of rank-and-file evangelicals, they either don't know who the power brokers are, or they like a bunch of different people that they see on TV, and they're going to make up their own mind. So it's like, they might say, oh, yeah, like, I like Don Wildman, or I like this person or that person, and they were at the Perry prayer rally, but you know what? I really like Michelle Bachman, or I really like Tim Pawlenty. He really connected with me. And so, in the end, you know, that may matter less. It might help Bachman that she's in Iowa and not, campaigning. Although, like, will the straw poll be taken as seriously given that, you know, she was essentially campaigning against Pawlenty? And I guess, you know, there's the little bit of the Ron Paul factor, which we forgot to factor in.
Well, we'll hear from the Paul supporters. I think you're right that I don't think Don Wildman or John Hughey or any of these guys are going to necessarily move the votes of people on the ground. I do think that who they decide to get behind could be important to some campaigns. So, for instance, if it becomes clear to Bachman that some of the big names aren't going to get behind her in terms of helping her out with their lists, which could be really useful for fundraising, then that, is a calculus she has to deal with. The same with Pawlenty. I don't buy the idea that he has until the straw poll to do well or he'll have to drop out. We have awfully short memories sometimes in the war. Because at this point in 2007, John McCain's campaign was in total disarray and people were, counting the days until he dropped out.
Right.
So I don't buy any of that. But, I also don't think that it will be irrelevant to Pawlenty's calculations who some of these big names are deciding to get behind. Right. In fact, it's probably far less relevant than the campaign will make it. But again, I think it has a special influence, an outsized influence for some of these folks.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. And, you know, remember that, you know, in 2007, Huckabee kind of came out of nowhere and came in second in the straw poll and then ended up winning the Iowa caucuses and then ended up losing.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, you can't, you know, Iowa is not perhaps what it, I mean, I think it's, you know, the Iowa is not the predictor that people think it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the whole race, though, is, you know, fairly, you know, from a strategic standpoint, you look at it and, you know, so you just try to game how it's all going to play out. And I think it's very difficult to predict how it's all going to play out at this point. And,
well, let me throw out another, question or topic kind of related. You said you'd wanted to get back to John Hagee, which we
Oh, yes, I do.
And I wanted to bring in Michelle Bachmann a little more, too, here, because she, kind of like Sarah Palin did in 2008, has recently been very vague about where she attends church and whether she's still affiliated with the Lutheran denomination that she was a few years ago. You know, she's been referring to herself as just a Christian, which a lot of evangelicals do. But I think we should point out that social conservatives are by and large evangelicals and Catholics. And I wonder whether Republicans are setting themselves up for a Catholic problem, just in terms of alienating some voters. If you've got Rick Perry, buddy-buddy with John Hagee, who calls the Catholic Church the Whore of Babylon, and Michelle Bachmann having belonged to a denomination that considers Catholics heretics and followers of the Antichrist.
So this is the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod that you're referring
to. Yes, Wisconsin Synod, you're right. You know, these are pretty inflammatory things. And again, it was one major reason why McCain moved to reject Hagee's endorsement, and you know, as we've already said, Perry's hardly doing that, and Bachmann, you know, is making some moves to set herself out there as just Michelle Bachmann Christian, but she's got some stuff in her past that could be fairly difficult.
Well, I think with the I think the Hagee thing is different from her membership in the WLES church, because Hagee, like himself, you know, was documented saying these things himself, and knowing that now, you know, these politicians are still cozying up with him. Then Bachmann belonged to this denomination which held that belief, and I can't remember what the exact phrasing is, and it's in their, you know, statement of faith type document. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
The details are not coming back to me at the moment. And I think it's a little bit harder to make the case that she's anti-Catholic based on that. Because a lot of people belong to denominations that where they don't, you know, check off everything and say, I believe. And, you know, granted, you know, one would hope that one would read the statement of faith of the church that they belong to, but maybe not. I don't know. It just, it's not as clear a case to me that she's anti-Catholic. The other thing is that, you know, for the arch-conservative Catholics, you know, I'm not talking about rank-and-file voters. I'm just talking about people in leadership positions at, you know, U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops or you know, in advocacy organizations, people like Jill Hudson or Bill Donahue, who doesn't really have a constituency in my view, but in any case, you know, but they've kind of made a political alliance with conservative evangelicals. Like, for example, Maggie Gallagher, who heads the National Organization for Women and is Catholic, was at this meeting with Robeson where, you know, Hagee was there, or at least one of these meetings. And so I think that they've made this strategic decision that, well, okay, you know, there's some of these people in here who make, have made, do make, have in their history making anti-Catholic comments, but it's more important to us to have this alliance with them so we can stop gay marriage than it is to get, you know, wrapped up in that sort of thing.
It's true.
Some I don't know if that's true.
That alliance, you know, Donahue, I at least give credit for going after everybody, whether you know, he's supposed to lay down his arms and you know, let John Hagee by. He was one of the most vocal who was really upset.
In fact, I think he was the one of the people who actually publicized. He was largely responsible for publicizing the anti-Catholic comment that.
And I suspect he would do the same for Bachman. So he could make life difficult for some of those folks. You know, as you say, he doesn't really have a constituency, but producers like bringing him on TV, and he could repeat those things over and over and over again. And,
right, he could, you know, he could make it difficult for Bachman
to respond.
But on the other hand, she could always say that, you know, well, I don't go to that church anymore, and we don't know why she doesn't go to that church anymore. She's never said. So I actually went there. I was
they
in Minneapolis.
They said they moved away, but they moved like 8 miles down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I was there. I actually went there. I went to a Sunday morning service when I was in Minneapolis a few weeks ago. And, you know, it's a very, let me put it this way, you know, given, you know, the kind of events that I normally cover, it had been a really long time since I had been in a church where they had an organ and a hymnal instead of a praise and worship band. It was very, very traditional that way. It was just very staid. It was like sort of a small A-frame wood building. And, you know, like
cool.
Had an organist. They sang from a hymnal. It was very, 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 very traditional and not that sort of not any kind of mega church vibe to it whatsoever, either in size or in the style of worship. So that was interesting. Like I didn't know what to expect. And that was, you know, basically, and it was, you know, there was no charismatic or Pentecostal anything to it at all. So, but you know, another religious constituency that Hagee is very controversial with is Jews, because one of the statement that he had made that really pushed McCain over the edge was his sermon unearthed by a blogger that in which he talked about the Holocaust being God's punishment on the Jews for their disobedience to his will. And you know, so for a lot of Jews, he's controversial from that, just for that, making that statement alone, but also because of his
involvement in Israel.
Is he right? And I think for Jews, that it's from the standpoint of, oh, you know, really, you know, his end times beliefs demonstrate that he thinks the Jews have to be converted or they'll be killed at Armageddon. And you know, he insists that he doesn't require Jews to be converted, but if you read what he writes about the end times, it is clear that he does believe that. But to me, it's kind of more that his whole foreign policy beliefs about Israel and Palestine and, you know, opposing the two-state solution, vehemently opposing the two-state solution and supporting settlements, is that he uses the Bible as a foreign policy tool. So it's like, you know, it doesn't matter, nothing matters except what the Bible says. So like God, you know, all of this is prophesied in the Bible. So forget the real politic of negotiating a peace settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians. You know, God ordained in the Bible that it should all come out this way. And so that's how it should come out. And that's just to me a very dangerous view. And that's probably, from my perspective, the most worrisome thing about him and the fact that politicians still cozy up to him is that they think that that he represents such a big constituency that they can continue to stonewall a peace agreement in Israel because that constituency opposes it.
Well, yeah. you know, I think one of the things we're absolutely agree on is that John Hagee carries a lot of risks for politicians who want to have a publicly close relationship with him. You know, you definitely outlined that, especially because people have been talking up the possibility of Republicans increasing their share of the Jewish vote, even though there have been a couple of polls that have come out recently showing that Jewish support for Obama hasn't budged really that much.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, it feels like one of those perennial topics that people always end up discussing around presidential campaigns of where the Jewish vote is going. And, you know, it's true that there has been some shifting back and forth in the last decade and a half. But I'm not sure that this is actually as big an issue for next year as sometimes portrayed.
Right.
A bigger one may
be
the Hispanic vote.
I think the Hispanic vote and/or the Catholic vote. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Hispanic vote and/or the Catholic vote.
Yes. Although, well, I guess I bring up Hispanics because obviously. I always feel ridiculous when I talk about the Catholic vote.
Right.
25% of the voting population. And I think within that, the Hispanic community is a really interesting one. And Hispanic evangelicals as well have been voting much more down the line with Republicans, but still are up for grabs. I think it is.
But they're a much smaller contingency than... or much smaller constituency than Latino Catholics.
It's true, but I was interested to see in your piece on the Robeson meetings that Sam Rodriguez is one of the people who's involved, because as you pointed out, he was on the Obama Advisory Council for the faith-based office. He's somebody who's brought in a lot to kind of be the conservative, but he's Hispanic, and we go along with him for Democrats, and yet he has been really active in the religious right, and appears to be active going into this campaign season as well.
Yes, he wasn't on Obama's advisory council, I don't think, but he has been brought to the White House for more informal advice.
He was at some of the meetings. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I think back in 2008, I thought that he was a little bit more movable on this stuff, or at least he appeared to me. I mean, I remember interviewing him in 2008 around the time of the Republican National Convention, and he complained to me about xenophobia at the RNC. And so I thought, okay, you know, here's somebody who might have some conservative beliefs on some of these social issues, right? Mm-hmm. But is kind of uncomfortable with the Republican Party.
Right.
And then, you know, after Obama gets elected, you know, sometimes he gets invited to the White House on, say, immigration stuff or I think mainly immigration stuff, trying to get, you know, a religious coalition to back immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, he'll show up at these religious right meetings and talk about how, you know, the healthcare reform bill is like the spirit of Herod and, you know, mm-hmm. implying that, you know, people who want healthcare reform are the equivalent of someone who would want to kill the baby Jesus. And so, you know, I didn't really, it was just, but I think he's more of late being in the past 1 to 2 years, more firmly put himself in the religious right camp than he had, I think, before 2008. But I don't know how much sway he actually has, because I actually think the numbers of churches that he says his organization represents is overstated. And, you know, I think that, like we said before, they're very much outnumbered by Latino evangelicals are outnumbered by Latino Catholics, and it may be only in a few states where the vote of Latino evangelicals would actually, you know, turn the vote, maybe Florida, Texas, California, New York, maybe. I don't know, that doesn't, it'll be interesting, but I don't, you know, I think that he's an interesting character. I'm it'll be interesting to see how he positions himself down the line.
Well, we have a few minutes to go before we wrap up, and I wanted to throw up there a wild card question, but let me know if it's unfair and we can change topics. But knowing that we have some debates coming up, in fact, I've lost count of the number of them before the caucuses actually start in Iowa in February this year. I wanted to get your thoughts on what would actually be a useful question to throw at the candidates to get kind of a sense of where they actually are on either church-state issues or kind of, you know, what the line is for them. Because we know we're going to get questions on evolution. Trying to remember what came up in the first debate. But things where, you know, it's the raise your hand if you, you know, believe in evolution or believe in creationism. That personally I don't think are that revealing about the candidates. What do you think, if you were going to moderate one of these debates, what would be useful to find out from the candidates?
Remember during the Elena Kagan confirmation hearings and Chuck Grassley asked her, I can't remember how he phrased it, but he asked her something like, do you think that the, I think he asked it specifically in reference to the Second Amendment, but I think he meant it as a sort of a broader question about her views of constitutional law, whether it was something that was divinely ordained. And, of course, Elena Kagan said she had never thought about it. but I think it's very revealing in terms of, like, do you think that the Constitution is, you know, basically divinely ordained and that, you know, to deviate, you know, sort of from the originalist view of the Constitution is... would be, you know, contrary to God, and that, you know, we're basically then therefore governed by, you know, a biblical view of the law. So I think that something that would be the most revealing about their views on the law and church and state issues would be to ask them that sort of question about the extent to which they think, if at all, biblical law should govern our jurisprudence and therefore our policy and legislation. It would be really interesting because I think they would be pressed to many people in their base to say that they believed in biblical law.
Right.
But I think that it would really be alarming to a lot of people. So what do you think? What would you ask?
I guess there are a couple of areas and it's not quite... I think your question is good because it gives it kind of a broad orientation. But because the question of banning Sharia from use in U.S. courts has been raised by a lot of the candidates, one of the things I would like is to have them pushed on that and to say, do you support laws to ban Sharia from consideration in things like arbitration cases? And if so, do you support banning all religious laws, so canon law, or, you know, but many times in Orthodox Jewish communities, things are sent to Jewish courts in arbitration.
And in Christian
you know,
contexts,
I think they
too.
Need to be pressed on, you know, a lot of times the supporters of this say, oh, it's not just about Islam. You know, we just think this is inappropriate. And, you know, but if that's true, then they would support banning all religious law from consideration. And I think that would be a difficult one for people. The other
I agree.
One,
I think
just
that's
because
a good
you know it's going to be an issue again, and I think some of these guys should be forced to make a statement and black and white instead of being wishy-washy on this is, do you think Barack Obama is a Christian? And not, well, he says he is, which is the answer that people give on stuff. But
right.
Yes or no, do you think he is? You know, this is a man who attended the same church in Chicago for 20 years. So, is he a Christian?
Right.
Was he a Christian when he was?
Well, I think they don't think that. I think a lot of them don't think that that church is a real
Christian. Right.
Christian.
Well,
I'm doing air quotes here, real Christian church.
Have to say that then.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That was the case that Glenn Beck was making last.
Exactly.
When he had his big rally. But,
well, Amy, when you and I run a debate for the Republican presidential candidates, we'll ask them all these questions, right?
Absolutely, because I have to think he would be at the top of the list for potential moderators. The campaigns would look at that and totally sign off.
Right, exactly. Well, this was a good conversation. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you.
Okay, take care. Hopefully we'll talk again soon.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks.